and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the backlash from Israeli officials, Jewish groups, and prominent senators and House members to remarks that Russia's President Putin made in an interview with NBC's Megyn Kelly, in which he blamed meddling in our 2016 election on Jews and other minorities. With Britain's Prime Minister May today telling Parliament that it is, quote, highly likely Russia was behind the attack in the UK on an exiled Russian spy and his daughter, who were poisoned by a type of military-grade nerve agent developed by Russia. We will look into how the Russian media is dealing with both the pushback from Russian election meddling and yet another assassination on British soil of former spies Putin has labelled as traitors who, quote, will kick the bucket, trust me. Julia Davis, the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russian media and the relationship between news and propaganda, joins us to discuss how, ahead of Russia's March 18 elections, Putin is becoming more brazen in signaling to the Russian people via state-controlled TV that he is their strong leader at war with the West, claiming in a two-hour documentary titled Putin that he had ordered the downing of a Turkish passenger plane that was reported to be hijacked and heading for the Sochi Olympics. Then, with the announcement today by the White House that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, who is soon to be crowned king, will meet with Trump on March the 20th, we will speak with Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, who is an expert on Saudi Arabian political affairs and Saudi-American relations. He joins us to discuss the extraordinary confiscation of wealth underway as MBS shakes down the fortunes and holdings of prominent Saudi princes, including the multi-billionaire Prince Alawid bin Talal, as well as the war MBS is bogged down in Yemen, in which thousands of innocent women and children are being bombed and starved to death. Then finally, we will review the Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's interview on 60 Minutes, which the Christian fundamentalist billionaire stumbled her way through, struggling to answer basic questions in a performance that even alarmed the White House. Mitchell Robinson, chair of music education at Michigan State University's College of Music and author of Privatize, Monetize, Weaponize, How the DeVos Family Devoured Michigan Schools, joins us to discuss the damage done so far to American education by this dim-witted dilettante. And joining us now is Julia Davis, the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russian media and the relationship between news and propaganda. A former federal officer, she served with the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection as an acting supervisor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julia Davis.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Prime Minister of the UK, Theresa May, just addressed the Parliament informing the British Parliament and the British people that the former Russian spy and his daughter who were poisoned in Salisbury were poisoned by a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia. And she's saying it's basically they've come to the conclusion that it's highly likely Russia was responsible for the attack on the former GRU colonel who arrived in the UK as a result of a spy swap that took place in 2010, where a group of sleeper agents here in the United States were swapped for Sergei Skripal and others. So this is, in effect, what the British Prime Minister is suggesting, is that agents of the Russian government, if not the Russian government itself, have attacked the United Kingdom with a weapon of mass destruction.
Yes, indeed, and it's very reminiscent of the Litvinenko poisoning as well.
So how is it being covered in the Russian media? Because I noticed that recently, I think he's probably the most prominent Russian news anchor on the main state television network, made all kinds of veiled references to the poisoning without admitting anything directly, but more or less warning people in a sarcastic way that if you're a traitor, even if you end up in the UK, you may not be safe.
Yes, the coverage has been twofold. On one hand, they are creating multiple conspiracy theories, as they usually do. That's a pretty good way to gauge the Kremlin's involvement is the number of conspiracy theories that pop up on Russian state media, which, of course, is directly controlled by the state. So on one hand, they are inventing all sorts of conspiracy theories, blaming the lab, blaming drug overdose, blaming the Brits or Americans. On the other hand, the anchor of the state media pretty much had given a warning to anyone who is considered to be a traitor that they're essentially dead men walking and they're not safe anywhere they go. And that has also been a very prevalent line in Russian state media. They preface Skripal's name with naming him as a traitor and saying that traitors have it coming. And, of course, Putin himself, in one of his old interviews, said that traitors always end up in a bad way. So, essentially, they sound very sinister and almost proud of their long reach of being able to conduct these assassinations on foreign soil.
So do you think this is in any way connected to the elections coming up on the 18th? In other words, Putin has been able to pull this off before with Litvinenko, not to mention links to the bombing of the apartment buildings that even brought him into power in the first place, all kinds of shady stuff, the death of Anna Politkovskaya, the investigative journalist who was murdered on Putin's birthday, the murder of Boris Nemtsov, literally next to the Kremlin. There's a pattern here where it seems that Putin is able to send a signal to the intelligence services and to the Russian people that I'm behind this wink and a nod, but at the same time not have his fingerprints directly on it.
I think it might very well be connected, and that is lately a very brazen approach of Russia to the world. Just like Putin's recent announcement about the super nukes, which he believes puts Russia in the position of strength, and the West will have to negotiate with them now. And I think this is a continuation of the same line, Putin pushing this line of his superiority and pretty much just brazenly telling the world that he can do whatever he wants and no one can stop him. And this is just one way of demonstrating this strength, is this far reach against what the Russians consider to be a traitor.
And again, I'm speaking with Julia Davis, the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russian media and the relationship between news and propaganda. A former federal officer, she served with the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection as an acting supervisor. And of course, one of the people that have been prominent on Russian media is Andrei Lugovoy, who's a member of the Russian Duma, and he's the person that the British government accused of poisoning Litvinenko with polonium-210, which you can only get from a nuclear reactor, hardly something you can get off the shelf.
Yes, and it seems like the Russian media is purposely putting Lugovoy on numerous state media outlets to comment about this case, and it seems like a very sinister trolling almost. They themselves apparently don't mind the Skripal case being tied with the Litvinenko case, again, as a demonstration of their perceived invincibility and ability to get away with doing whatever they find necessary.
So this, you think, is connected to the elections then? What, if so, what is the signal that Putin is sending to the Russian people?
The signal, I believe, is that he is the strong, invincible leader, that anyone who attempts to stand in his way will be crushed, and that he is not afraid of the West or their sanctions or any repercussions.
So Putin, of course, there's a huge documentary on Russian television that's a complete Valentine to Putin. Of course, there was a long Valentine done to Putin by Oliver Stone that was broadcast on Showtime. But this time it's playing on Russian media. It's a two-hour documentary called Putin, And in it, of course, it's clearly a piece of, you know, election propaganda, effectively. But he does, Putin talks about how he gave the orders to shoot down a plane that was hijacked, at least that's what they thought at the time, and was heading crash into the Sochi Olympics. So he's basically advertising himself, again, as a strong leader. What do you make of this two-hour documentary?
He wanted to make sure that, again, the same message gets across, that he is capable of doing anything, that he was willing to shoot down the plane of a NATO member, and sending the same signal that he is afraid of nothing and don't mess with me, essentially, is the message.
So one of the reasons I called you was that you've been quoted in The Guardian and the BBC in response to the remarks that Putin made in the interview that he did with the NBC anchor Megyn Kelly, where he basically used some pretty crude and anti-Semitic language, saying that in terms of this accusation about Russian meddling in the 2016 elections, which Putin denied, to Megyn Kelly, he more or less said, well, it could have been, you know, Jews or Ukrainians and non-Russians. So I know for the longest time there's been a fairly flagrant racism. It used to be in the Soviet Union as well, particularly towards Chechens and others. They use the word Chornya, the equivalent of the N-word in this country. So what's Putin signaling there by using these kind of this racist language?
It was very surprising to hear, because he brought it up seemingly for no reason whatsoever. Obviously, it had to do with Russian citizens interfering in U.S. elections, but he made it clear that he doesn't consider ethnic minorities to be real Russians, which shows his own despicable tendencies. And also in the same statement, he said that they may have been paid by the Americans. So to me, that sounds like the beginnings of yet another conspiracy theory that will probably soon be spawned by Russian state media. It will say that they were not ethnically Russian, which I guess in Putin's eyes somehow is more acceptable than if they were ethnically Russians. He didn't consider them to be real Russians if they're the Jews or Ukrainians or Tatars. And so obviously this is a setup, I think, for the next conspiracy theory that we'll hear, that those were not ethnically Russian people that were bought by the Americans. And that it's quite a racist and unacceptable message to send. But in the Russian state media, they're not commenting about that at all. And those comments are not considered to be controversial, which only shows that anti-Semitism and discrimination against minorities is alive and well in modern Russia.
Well, you can understand the remark about Ukrainians, because Putin's at war with Ukraine, using a proxy war. He doesn't want to have a full, all-out invasion, obviously, because then he'd have to occupy Ukraine and be subject to guerrilla warfare. But he has been able to destabilize Ukraine and keep this bloody wound, this low-intensity warfare going. And he's also occupied Crimea, where the Tatars are, and he considers the Tatars disloyal because they're not happy about Russian occupation. But why the Jews?
Because it's a theory that many Russians would be comfortable with, because anti-Semitism is still alive and well. So the theories about the Jews being responsible for all sorts of ill misdeeds would be pretty well accepted by the Russians. And also, you know, with the recent rise of rampant Nazi movements all over the world, he's probably trying to tap into those segments of the population who would buy into that sort of a story.
So when he says about the meddling in the U.S. elections, that I couldn't care less because they do not represent the government, talking about whoever these people might have been, I could not care less. They do not represent the interests of the Russian state. Maybe they're not even Russians, but Ukrainians, Tatars, Jews, just with Russian citizenship. Even that needs to be checked. Maybe they have dual citizenship, or maybe a green card. Maybe it was the Americans who paid them for this work. How do you know? I don't know. So that's the full statement there. So he's throwing up quite a lot of confusion, if you will, on disinformation. But isn't that the hallmark of the media in Russia today? There was a very good book written, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, that by just sowing confusion, you basically obfuscate the fact that you and the Siloviki are looting the country, stealing them blind, and using outside threats as a justification to distract people from your misrule.
That is exactly the point. They're trying to muddy the information space to the point where it's unclear what really happened, and that's why they're throwing every possible conspiracy theory out there so that in the end people just get tired of it and start to think that there's no way to know what really happened. And by Putin claiming that they were the trolls or hackers are not acting on behalf of the Russian state, that's exactly why he's using mercenaries operated by the same person, Prigozhin, who also ran the troll farms, is to create this plausible deniability where he can always claim that he had nothing to do with it when, in fact, everything is being done with full knowledge and participation of the Kremlin.
So there's been quite a backlash to Putin's statement about blaming it on the Jews, the meddling in the U.S. elections in 2016. There's been condemnation from Israel, from the Anti-Defamation League, and from a number of prominent Democrats in the Senate and the House, Schumer, Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, Gerald Nadler, and others. Many are calling upon President Trump to say something or to rebuke Putin in any way, but for reasons which you don't understand, President Trump has never rebuked Putin for anything that he said or done. So do you expect Putin to make any kind of apology?
No, I'm actually not expecting Trump to criticize Putin for reasons that I'm sure at some point in time will come out. He has not criticized Putin even once, so I fully expect that he will not say anything about this matter either.
So when Putin used the word Rusky, which is a term denoting ethnic Russians, is that a division that's understood in Russia, that you either are Rusky or you're not?
There is a distinction between a person that is Russian by their ethnicity versus a Russian citizen. So there are two different words to describe that in the Russian language, whereas in English we would simply say the Russians. So there is such a distinction there, ethnically Russian versus Russian by citizenship.
But don't the Russians have a problem if you further alienate minorities? Don't they have a substantial Islamic population, for example, not just in the Caucasus, but much closer to Moscow?
Yes, I'm sure decent Russians do have a problem with the way ethnic minorities are being treated, but you will not hear much about that on Russian state TV or in Russian state media.
And why is that? I mean, because this is one of the most amazing things that I find hard to follow, that in this country a lot of people on the political left watch RT, and they supported the candidate of RT, which was the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein. And she, of course, was sitting next to Putin at that infamous RT 10th anniversary dinner with General Flynn and the father of Julian Assange. They were seated at that table that's gotten a lot of attention, mostly because of General Flynn's appearance there. But the idea that somehow people in the West think that Putin is, what, I don't know, a socialist or something, and they don't recognize him in the context of far-right-wing, racist, ultra-Orthodox religion. I mean, I kind of think of an American equivalent, but if he were in the American political spectrum, he'd be somewhere like near Rick Santorum or the Reverend Jerry Falwell, the late Reverend Jerry Falwell, or somebody like that. I mean, Why is it that people don't recognize on the political left in Western Europe and in the United States that this guy is essentially a right-wing fascist, a religious fascist?
I think it's good that you mentioned RT, because in this context it's very important to recognize RT for what it actually is. The editor-in-chief of RT, Margarita Simonian, admitted that RT was created after Russia invaded Georgia in 2008, and they didn't have any tool in the information war with the West to respond to Russia being accused of invading Georgia. So at that point, RT was created as a tool of information war against the West. And what they did is, for many years, they have worked on normalizing Russia and Putin's policies with the West. And what they, the way they did it is they would invite politicians, whistleblowers, anyone who's considered to be on the fringe in politics or in the society, they would invite them on their shows and making them feel like they only have a voice on RT, and solidifying their future loyalty. And then in 2014, when Russia attacked Ukraine, RT became more brazen in spreading conspiracy theories and outright lies. But at that point, those elements that they had previously gotten their loyalty by inviting them on the show, they pretty much secured them as their loyal supporters. And a lot of them may not even look any deeper than the shows that they watch on RT or participate in, and may not realize fully what they're supporting, because they're believing stories that are being spun on Russian state media.
But just in closing, how would you describe Putin as a political figure in terms of the political spectrum from left to right? Because my understanding is that he's really a far-right politician that's tied in with the ultra-Orthodox Church, family values, all of these very conservative markings of a far-right politician here in the United States. And yet a lot of people on the political left, like the Jill Steins, the Oliver Stones, the editors of The Nation and others, somehow see him as something of a hero. Whether they think he's on the left or not, I'm not sure. That would be pretty hard to imagine. But so that's my question to you. How do you see him in terms of the political spectrum?
In terms of the political spectrum, I see Putin closer to the far right than he would be to anything else. But at the same time, he is more than willing to exploit youthful idiots from any part of the political spectrum. He does not mind using the far left or far right. He will pretty much go whichever way he has to achieve his objectives. But he is an authoritarian thug with views that are closer to the far right, certainly.
Well, Julia Davis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julia Davis, who's the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russian media and the relationship between news and propaganda. She's a former federal officer who served with the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection as an acting supervisor. We're going to take a brief station break and be discussing the extraordinary confiscation of wealth underway as the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince shakes down the fortunes and holdings of prominent Saudi princes. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He's a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, and Saudi political history, and Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, otherwise known as MBS, had a successful visit to the UK, and he's now about to come to the United States, where I'm sure he'll be feted at the White House. So what's your understanding of why he's coming to the US, and what do you expect from these photo ops at the White House?
The main reason that Mohammed bin Salman is coming to the United States and to visit with Mr. Trump is basically to begin his career as the new king of Saudi Arabia. This is his crowning tour. He is going to become king. Just a few months ago, he overthrew his rival and cemented his control. And this is the first time he gets to leave the country and come to his allies and supporters who made it happen, especially the United States.
So the United States has been incredibly silent on the massive confiscation of wealth underway in Saudi Arabia, where the Crown Prince MBS arrested a number of princes, including Alawid bin Talal, who's a very prominent international businessman, a multi-billionaire. He's still in confinement, from what I understand. They were put up in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh, and they literally, in some cases, tortured, in many cases, abused, and forced to hand over big chunks of their fortunes and their companies and control of their companies. That would be absolutely amazing if that happened here in the United States or any other Western country. It would be getting massive coverage. But for reasons which I find a little mystifying, very little is being said about it, really.
Well, this is very clear that the United States has not spoken that under any administration regarding massive human rights abuse, especially the issue of women, which where a country basically treats women as slaves. So the arrest of a few business people who were corrupt anyways will not irk Western government, namely the UK and the US. And additionally, that they will benefit from this money because this is basically Mohammed bin Salman is robbing Paul to pay Tom. And, that's what's going to happen. The money or part of the money that was collected from these mostly corrupt members of the ruling family and businessmen, it will end up in America and the UK in forms of arms sales and contracts. Some of them are corrupt contracts, obviously, and maybe some kickbacks as well. So I think they were benefiting from it. That's why they wouldn't say anything about it.
Well, what was announced when MBS recently went to London was that the Saudis are purchasing 48 Tornado fighters manufactured in the UK. And that leads to this extraordinary military that the Saudis have built up over the decades. And apparently MBS, who's also the defense minister, is frustrated that in spite of the billions that they've spent on all the best hardware you can possibly get your hands on, they're not doing very well in Yemen.
Oh, yes, I don't think they are doing very well in Yemen, and it's because regardless of how many weapons you have, it doesn't matter, and as long as you don't have a professional army. The Saudi army is basically meant to defend the Saudi monarchy against internal forces, and no amount of weapons will change that. And the ruling family has always feared a strong and capable army because it really is terrified from a coup. Just we saw in Egypt in the 50s and in Iraq in the 50s as well, and in other countries, Libya and others, where monarchies were taken down and replaced by military officers. That's why the Gulf countries have all made sure that their armies are fickle armies that cannot coordinate, and it is not a professional army. It starts with largely sectarian tribal force, not your average modern army.
Well, but that hasn't stopped MBS from having a film made about him, which is being shown on Saudi TV and on the internet, of the young Crown Prince leading the Saudi army into battle against Tehran, against the Iranians.
Yes, I think we have a word back home. It's hiyat, and it means that's a very local word. It's only used in Saudi Arabia. Hiyat is that typical Saudi hiyat, which means that it's a lot of basically show off and hot air that end up in nothing. They have not been able to defeat a branch in Yemen, not the entire country of Yemen, because some of them are not fighting the Saudis. But what they call a militia, it's not a militia, but these forces in Yemen have nothing, no supply line, and they don't have tanks or air force, and they are able to withstand Saudi bombardment backed by the United States and the United Kingdom from day one. So Iran has much more powerful army than that, so they're not going to be able to achieve what that's shown on that video game. It's a video game that doesn't mean anything.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. But of course, what's missed in all of this, Ali, is the fact that there's a blockade going on in Yemen. Yemeni civilians, women and children are starving to death. It's a human rights catastrophe. The same is true in Syria, where people are being bombarded and murdered in wholesale and starved to death. So this proxy war between the Saudis and the Iranians, two hideous regimes, the Al-Saud regime and the religious regime of the mullahs, the supreme leader, Khamenei's, they're both equally unpopular with their own people, from what I can tell. But this hasn't stopped them from causing massive misery in Syria, Iraq, and in Yemen. So how much longer can this go on?
I wanted to correct the fact that this is not a proxy war in Yemen. In other places, yes, there are no Iranian forces in Yemen. Yes, there are some Iranian arms, but those Iranian arms basically pale in comparison to the British and American arms. So it's not a proxy war. I think that is the line that the Saudis and their Western backers are saying. This is between Iran and, in fact, this is between the Yemeni people and the Saudis and the Saudi monarchy, who they don't want a Yemen that is stable, that is independent of their influence. They don't want a Yemen that is capable of defending itself. And that's why this war was waged. And the Saudi strategy in Yemen has been always to weaken and divide that country. And now even some Yemenis have turned against Saudi Arabia, including Tawakkul Kurman, who was supporting this war in the beginning. We have reports that Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, who is the Yemeni president backed by the United States and Saudi Arabia, is now under house arrest in Riyadh. So you see that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are making Yemen, so Iran is just a small player in Yemen. It's not a leading player. Yes, they do support the what people call the Houthis, but with what? With maybe money and political statements and maybe media and some arms, definitely.
But Ali, there are
proxy too for Iran.
I get what you're saying, but there are Iranian manufactured Scud missiles. One of them landed at the main airport in Riyadh.
They also used North Korean weapons,
sure.
and Russian weapons and even American weapons. It doesn't make you a proxy if you use a weapon or buy it, even if you get it for free. But the idea is that they are not agents of Iran. That is something that we need to they are not. They don't do this because these people they live in Yemen and their country has been bombed. So the natural thing to do is to fight back, and they didn't invade Saudi Arabia. I know that in the West, that's very convenient to say because it makes it much more palatable and it excuses the British and American official position, which supported this war from day one. In fact, before the war was started in 2015. The Obama administration had knew about it, had supported it, had in fact lobbied for it, and this thing continues because they don't want to have an independent or control in Yemen for a force that force, no matter what it is religious, close to Iran in terms of ideology, or a sectarian force or a secular force for that matter. Well, if you go back to the 1950s in Iran, the person that the CIA overthrew was a secular liberal. So, and the same thing with Silvardo Olandi. It's not really about what these people think, as long as it has nothing to do with the United States and the UK positions in terms of if they are allies of the United States, everything is excusable. And it's excused. If they are not, everything is bad, no matter how good these people are.
But what we can say is that the Iranians have been incredibly much more successful than the Saudis. The Saudi influence in Syria was largely with al-Nusra and these radical groups, and they're being rolled up along with the Islamic State, whereas Iran looks like they've got a land bridge now from Tehran all the way to Beirut and Damascus, since they have so much influence in Iraq. And of course, as we've discussed earlier, Saudi Arabia's involvement in Yemen and the Gulf states, by the way, they're paying a heavy price as well. They're just absolutely getting nowhere but causing massive human misery. So that much of an observation you can make, surely, that the Iranians have been more successful in prosecuting wars in their interests at the expense, of course, of lots of Syrian civilians.
Absolutely. I think where the Iranians have, their influence is rising and the Saudis are failing. But I don't think really, in my opinion, it's because of the Iranians' good work or anything. I think the Iranians have many problems of their own. I think what happened is that the nature of the region has changed. And I would say maybe history is movement is not in favor of the Saudis because their system, their regime, remains against the times. The Iranians are not, great or anything like that, but they are closer to the time than the Saudis in terms of their political system and their general. But the Iranians also having problems that we saw in these ongoing demonstrations against these ridiculous restrictions and their population and the limited freedoms that they offer to their people. So I think that is why this is happening. Now, the existence of the difference between Iran and Saudi Arabia is this, in my opinion, two. One historical difference, and then the second one is modern and contemporary difference. The historical difference is in Islamic history, the majority of Muslim ideological work was made or created in Iran by Persians. All the Muslim scholars who shaped Islam, mostly it's a Sunni Islam, by the way, were Iranians or Persians, for that matter, from the early ages of Islam. And Iran was the largest landmass where Islamic work in terms of scholarly work and art and so on was created in Iran. History aside, right now, the people of the region, across their political spectrum, have a very negative view of the West because of these ongoing wars that really now are very clear that were created by the West or encouraged by the West to drive wealth and talent from the region toward the West and to keep the people of the region under basically the shoes of Western governments. So they are not able to move forward to build societies that are modern, that are secular, that that goes beyond that go beyond you know sect or tribe or you know religion. I think if you see the American and British policies in the region have been always against power of the people, against independence of these nations. They wanted people who basically kowtow to their own designs, buy arms from the UK and the United States. You know, it was very disturbing a few days ago when Mohammed bin Salman was in London. The UK government issued this statement saying that we export to the Gulf much more than we export to China and India combined. And the 90% of those exports are bombs and guns and you know military equipment. And that's very disturbing. This is how the British people supposedly making a living by selling death to this region. This is very disturbing. We thought they can sell us Cadbury and you know English tofu or something instead of or taffy. I'm sorry, English taffy instead of arms. And I think that is one of the reasons that the people in the region have really seen this, and they say we rather have an independent like Iran is. You know, it's not a good organization or good government. Better than somebody who is there because of U.S. and British support, the Saudis and other governments.
Well, just in closing, back to the confiscation of wealth underway with MBS shaking down the other princes. Most, of course, were King Abdullah's sons. I think there's some animus there between branches of the royal family. But and also there was, of course, a prominent death in custody of General Qahtani. Is an officer with the Saudi National Guard. He appears to have been tortured brutally. So there's a lot going on there. But one of the things two things that bother me. One is that Jared Kushner shook down the Qataris for $500 million to bail out 666 Fifth Avenue. Whether or not some of this confiscated money from the Saudi princes via MBS is going to bail out 666, that's a story I'm looking into at the moment. Mm-hmm. But Jared and his brother met with MBS just a few days before he arrested all of these princes and took their money away. So there's some suspicion there. But the other thing that bothers me is this recent article by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, who spent time with MBS, who obviously got completely flattered and taken in by him and talked of him as a great reformer. I mean, a lot of the stuff that he's doing in Saudi Arabia, sure, he's giving women the right to drive cars, but he's, for example, he just confiscated and shut down a whole bunch of popular TV shows like the equivalent of The Voice here or American Idol. It's called Arabs Have Got Talent. So that's not the act of a reformer, is it?
No, Mohammed bin Salman is no reformer, you know, and I wouldn't take Thomas Friedman seriously because he said that before, and we're actually working on a report detailing that issue. He doesn't know the country, and what he writes is I really put it in the ideological and business section. This is what Thomas Friedman wants. He thinks he can sell us tomato and call it cake. That is not the reality. The reality is everybody knows that Mohammed bin Salman is the leading killer of children in Yemen. Even the UN kind of trying to change that issue by not listing the number of children killed due to the war, but they say every 10 minutes children die in Yemen because of lack of medicine or food. And that is basically as if you put a child in a cage and they die and you say, I didn't do it. You know, he died because he was in a cage. And that's what the Saudis have done. The largest number of children in the world who have died at the Saudi hand. And Thomas Friedman, I don't think he cares about, you know, tens of thousands of Yemeni children. And that's why he didn't even care to mention it, let alone call somebody who kills these children a reformer. I would take strong position if somebody says that calls me a reformer or calls anybody a reformer who killed tens of thousands of children. This is ridiculous, and I think I say this is nothing but a racist and bigoted view, because children, no matter where they come from, are holy, and anybody who kills them is an evil person, and Mohammed bin Salman is one of those people.
Well, Ali Al-Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Al-Ahmed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. We're going to take a restation break. We'll be back reviewing the Education Secretary Bessie DeVos's stumbling performance on 60 Minutes that even alarmed the White House. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mitchell Robinson, who's the chair of the music education at Michigan State University's College of Music. He's written extensively about Bessie DeVos, and he has a recent article at the Eclectic blog, Privatize, Monetize, Weaponize, How the DeVos Family Devoured Michigan's Schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mitchell Robinson.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And Bessie DeVos was on 60 Minutes last night, and her performance was so bad that it's even alarmed the White House. And as we know, the White House has not set a very high bar for the kind of people that they're hiring. So she, of course, I think she has a record in the sense that Vice President Pence had to break a tie vote in her Senate confirmation, making her the first cabinet nominee in American history to require a tie-breaking vote by the vice president to be confirmed. So that wasn't a particularly auspicious start, was it?
No, and I'm sorry to say it has not gotten any better. Mrs. DeVos has been in this job now for over a year. She has access to the best experts in the world on education policy, and judging from what we've seen so far of her policy beliefs and her moves in office, she's not taken advantage of any of that. If possible, she's gotten worse.
Well, specifically, she was asked about the Michigan school system. And so since you're a Michigander, give us a short version of what she tried to do, her and her husband, who's also a billionaire, and what they tried to do and what the results have been.
Well, it was pretty much a scorched earth kind of approach here in Michigan. The schools 20, 25 years ago were among the best in the country. There's a very strong higher education ecosystem here. Public schools were very strong. And there were a series of policy moves that she was very heavily invested in and moved behind the scenes primarily. Until her ascendance to the secretary's position, she's really been a behind-the-scenes kind of character, both in Michigan and nationally. But she pushed hard twice for vouchers in the state, both times. That went down to kind of a crushing defeat, about 70% to 30%. And she's also worked really hard to destabilize unions in the state. So pretty much now the schools have really been systematically defunded and destabilized. At the same time, she's been the primary cheerleader for the expansion of charter schools, specifically in Michigan, for-profit charter schools in the state. Her rationale, as was discussed last night, is that she believes that, A, that private school vouchers and charter schools and other kinds of privatization efforts will strengthen public schools, and she also believes that cutting public school education budgets will strengthen public schools. And I think it's pretty easy to show that she's crushingly wrong on both of those things.
Well, since this 60 Minutes appearance, Betsy DeVos has been tweeting out about, in defense of her record in Michigan, and she's saying also missing from the 60 Minutes is students at charter schools in Detroit are doing two times better than their peers. The reforms are helping, but there's so much more to do. We must help all students be better prepared for strong futures. Well, she couldn't answer the simple question of the logic. If you take money away from public schools and give them to charter schools, you're hardly helping the already underfunded public schools. So when she says that the charter schools are doing two times better, well, surprise, surprise.
Well, you know, she's also, I mean, it was interesting that in the tweet that she sent out about that point specifically, she linked to an article from a local news source here. And if you go and actually click on that link, the article is not at all supportive of the point that she's trying to make. The differences in charter school performance and traditional public school performance in Detroit are just about negligible. Most serious education researchers would scoff at any kind of a power effect on these findings. And you know, you also have to keep in mind that the primary reason that the schools in Detroit have struggled as they have is because of the defunding that Mrs. DeVos and her family and their foundations have been behind for the past 15 to 20 years. So, you know, it's kind of a neat trick to destabilize and demoralize a public school system in the state's largest city, clear the field for competition to come in, and then crow about a 1 or 2% difference in student achievement between the schools. You know, we're also talking about public schools that educate about 90% of our country's children versus charters that are educating less than 10%. And I'm still struggling a year after she's taken office why the Secretary of Education for the entire country is focusing on a boutique approach to education instead of the system of education that's been largely responsible for getting our country where it is today.
But she's not the only billionaire that's meddling in the education system and advocating for charter schools. Eli Broad, who's big philanthropist here in L.A., he was meddling in the Detroit school system, was he not?
There have been a lot of people with a lot of money that see schools in general as an untapped revenue source. Yeah, so she's far and away not the only person. There's an awful lot of money, probably trillions, to be made by betting on public education and privatizing it. So you're exactly right.
Well, I'm not sure that Eli Broad was about, you know, making money out of it. And Bill Gates is another billionaire. They seem to have this kind of altruistic idea that because they're successful businessmen, somehow you can apply business models to education.
Well, I think with all due respect, I think you're being a little bit too kind. I don't really think that Mr. Gates was committed to any kind of systemic improvement of curriculum or student learning. My more partisan take on Gates is that he's looking for a place to sell more computers and more software. He's also now kind of stepped away. You know, the Common Core has kind of faded away. And he's also stepped away from influencing large-scale curriculum changes because virtually every initiative that Gates has funded has proven to either be not successful or there's no significant impact. So, Mr. Gates, I think, has more than altruistic motives here for his meddling in public education. I don't know exactly about Mr. Broad because he's mostly focused on the West Coast at this point.
Well, the one thing, though, that was so, I mean, there were a lot of moments in the interview that Betsy DeVos did on 60 Minutes last night. The White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was asked whether the president had seen it all, and she said, "I'm not sure if he saw the whole thing or not." Not exactly a ringing endorsement.
No.
But I watched it, you watched it, and one of the more disturbing, I mean, it's embarrassing. She's obviously there because she's got a lot of money, not because she has any talent. She may have a good heart, you know, I mean, I'm not going to dismiss her out of hand, but the point is that she was asked a question because we know that she sided with the rapists on campus rather than the victims. So the question was quite simple. What are the statistics? Are there more victims of men who have been wrongly accused of rape than there are women who have been raped on campus? She couldn't answer that question.
Well, I think this is a disturbing trend. You know, Mrs. DeVos has strong beliefs. And, you know, your position on it, I think, is like most people. We're not questioning the strength of her beliefs, but they're not based on anything. They're not based on anything other than her unshaking conviction that she's right about these things. And, you know, as someone who has taught in schools for about 40 years now, you know, Mrs. DeVos never attended a public school. She didn't send her own children to a public school, and she's never taught in a public school. So her firsthand knowledge of public schools is limited to about 6 hours of mentoring a couple of kids in the Grand Rapids schools, one of which, by the way, she then enticed to leave the public school and go to a private school. So Mrs. DeVos's track record of being an advocate for public education is non-existent, and so is the knowledge base upon which she's basing her decisions regarding policy.
Well, just in closing then, Mitchell Robinson, do you expect any changes from the White House as a result of her being, I mean, she was exposed for her total ignorance of education during the Senate confirmation, which, as I mentioned, she broke the record of being the first to have required a tie vote from the vice president to get confirmed in American history. It's not obviously gotten any better. The question would be, can she somehow be eased out of there before she does any more damage?
Well, under a normal administration, the Senate confirmation hearing would have been a no-go, and last night would have been a deal-breaker, but we're clearly not living in a normal time. So I don't know. The only saving grace here is that the president doesn't seem to like when members of his cabinet attract any kind of attention. He likes all of that on himself. So it could be that he is not happy with her performance. And that's what I think he sees all of his cabinet secretaries as being performers. And he wasn't happy with that performance, so he may look for someone else for that role. I shudder to think what the next person, what their profile would be like.
Well, Mitchell Robinson, I thank you for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Mitchell Robinson, who's the chair of music education at the Michigan State University's College of Music. He has written extensively about Betsy DeVos and has a recent article at the Eclecta blog, Privatize, Monetize, Weaponize, How the DeVos Family Devoured Michigan's Schools. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.